where you're going, where you're going. If there is no speech, he said, should be the first. If there is no writing, the second. If there is no fatherhood, the third. The creation of the arts and sciences. Now all this, gentlemen, is the story of how the men whom you and I consider men, whom you know as a human being, how they, he was created. In our era, we can find, feel brotherhood, a brotherhood that we cannot find with a pagan Red Indian. And therefore there's a break in history, because I said to you, since 957 years, there's an attempt to make sure that those who speak write, those who write, also are founders and ancestors of the future, and those who live in any time are able to go back to the beginning by art and science. If men today, I mentioned Richard Wagner, writes magic fire music, or if Mr. Einstein tells us how to think of the universe in new terms of relativity, they once more put us back to the beginning, to the original feeling of the first men. They sharpen our imagination, our senses. Now all this, gentlemen, today is available to any human being. We should see that this was not true in antiquity. A Greek was a Greek, a Jew was a Jew, a Scythe, as it says in the New Testament, was a Scythe, and a Roman was a Roman. They could not exchange. They had to be what they were totally. And what you call a Stone Age Indian, for example, in the Amazonas basin, would be a man who can only be a tribesman. And to touch him, the white man comes and brings him whiskey, and he dies, he perishes, because he cannot mix, he cannot mingle with a compound, you see, of a richer world. It breaks up his own standards of behavior. This is, as you know, the tragedy today in Africa, where all the cadres and structures of the Negro tribes are destroyed, or have already been destroyed for centuries by the slave traders. And so it is quite serious. We are still surrounded, gentlemen, by people who do not share this great adventure of exchange, of making available to all men all these new qualities. We, you and I, however, very naively take it for, you, most of you, take it for granted that the world is there for the asking, that you can get, go to Europe, make the Pope, and you can go to Saudi Arabia and buy the oil or steal it, or you can go into the future, into the past, you can enjoy all these various things. You have the players, and you have chapel service, and you have it all one next to the other. This intermingling, this combination, gentlemen, however, isn't so simple. You can spoil your stomach by mixing without first principle, without very great severity. And the story of our era, gentlemen, as you well know, this era is called the Christian era for this reason, that Christ laid down the law under what conditions there could be one unified humanity. After all, he is the first man who does not belong to his own people, but he is more than a Jew. And that's why there are great difficulties arising from this fact. Who is he then? The people say, the nationalists, you see. Today, where there is little Christianity left, they try very hard to transform it into a Jew. You know, there are many Jewish writers today who have written books on St. Paul as though they were nothing but Jews. And everybody feels there's something wrong. They belong to an era in which you are not just a Jew, or not just a Greek, or not just a red Indian. Not one of you can be nailed down for his family descent. You can say, you can cover a wider area of meanings. You are not just your father's son, and therefore we no longer can express or describe a human being in terms of one of these four units. You are not just a tribesman, that would be a family man, because in the tribe the family relations are the essential thing. You are not just a native of a country, because everybody who lives in America, that's a good example of the Christian era, came from another country, and now you are Americans. Therefore, it is possible to change one's country, and you can be, therefore, not just pigeonholed by saying that you are a native of one country, gentlemen. It's very important. It's nearly lost at this moment. Yesterday, I saw a book, The American Nation. I think that's prescribed reading in some courses. Well, I think America will perish as soon as you think that America is just a nation. America is much more than a nation. If you are just a nation like any other country, it is perfectly inexplicable how people from all nations of the world could become Americans. We are a little bigger than a nation. And that's very pertinent. This cause is devoted to making you feel proud of your heritage. You are more than just a member of a nation. Or you would be unfit after the two world wars to play your role in the world. America, you see, is now leading the democracies of the Western world, or it's trying to integrate the world. Well, how could you, if all of you were just nationalists, you see? Then the other nations would have to repudiate you and say, we don't believe you, because all you can do is just think of America. So this is a very terrible, terrifying title of this book, The American Nation. We come to this at greater length, and I can show you that the founders of this country never thought that America was just a nation. And America is not a nation. It's a melting pot, it's the new world, it's the standard bearer of freedom, it's the standard of democracy, but certainly it's not just a nation. I mean, we may feign this, and we may ask the Albanians and to the people in Honduras to vote for us in a resolution in the United Nations, Benjamin, but we are concealing the fact that we are a member of the United Nations, and besides, we are the United States of America. And that's something that's bigger than being a member of the United Nations. Much bigger. Yes, you don't believe it. It seems to me that your generation tries to feel very small. Then, of course, Benjamin, anybody today cannot just be an Israelite, or he cannot be just a Greek. He cannot just be a scientist, he also has to be a member of the country, and he cannot just be a member of a religious sect. Anyone, take the Mormons, and without combining it with some feeling of mission. Now the Israelites, as you know, do not accept mission. As a part of their religion. But in the Christian era, every one of us wants to infect somebody else with a sense of mission. We are all living today, that is, we want to communicate to people who are not yet participating. The difference between Christianity and Israel is mainly in this fact, you see, that Christianity is a spreading faith. And Israel is a waiting faith, letting the others come to see. So, gentlemen, if ye now shall name these next chapters, we'll have to claim one thing for any one of these 3,000 years, the one which ended around the year 999, because then at that time the last island of the Western world, Iceland, did what? What did happen in 1999? Anybody knows? Do you have any Scandinavian here? Don't you know what happened? Yes, Mr. Torres. Yes? Yes. What?
How was the question?
In 999, your king in Iceland didn't accept Christianity, didn't it? Well, I'm delighted, sir. It took a whole year. It's a very small difference, isn't it? I think I can prove to you it was 999. they began the calendar at a different day of the year. Do you know when the year started in the year 1000? The new year? On March 25th. Got it. Anyway, the pervading question of the last 2,000 years, or 1957 if you want to, is unity. That is, gentlemen, there were, of course, in the beginning, innumerable speaking units. We may say that in the beginning there must have been 100,000 different languages. There are still in the world perhaps 15,000 different languages. That's quite a big number. 9,000 of them in Africa alone, over 9,000. And that must bring you to the insight that speech at the first moment was pluralistic. I mean, there were innumerable languages. And it was already a great achievement that a few hundred people would speak one tongue, you see. That's something you never consider, how difficult it is to make 200 people speak the same language. You see, you think that's just child's play. But you see that every effort had to be made, you see, to have many languages. Now, of course, the unity of the church, gentlemen, is an attempt to give everybody the same Father in heaven. So the church created the unity of fatherhood, while before there had been innumerable languages, innumerable countries, innumerable empires, and innumerable religions, and also innumerable different arts and sciences. We'll see then that, gentlemen, the first 1,000 years of our era, we are concerned with the founding of the church as a unity of religion. And what was fought in the first 1,000 years of our era, gentlemen, were the many gods. So the church responded here to chapter 3. And the first, chapter 5, gentlemen, then tries to eliminate the many gods. And we can call this chapter, gentlemen, God against the gods. And the significance is that there is, for the first time, permeating the whole world the knowledge that there is unity, as against the many. The second step, since Iceland became Christian in the June of the year 1000, is that the world has become one. In antiquity, or in India even today, a good Brahma can believe that there are many worlds, that there is only one world, gentlemen, and that you count in all the worlds into your world picture, that you can read Mr. Harvey Shapley's wonderful description of the universe with its many hundred millions of light years is something utterly new, gentlemen. We only think in these terms for the last 200-300 years. Even the North Pole, as you know, and the South Pole have only been discovered in the last 100 years. And therefore, gentlemen, it is one world. Out of all countries, out of all empires, which had to be created, and the last event, of course, in this story are the two world wars. The two world wars demand one world peace, which would mean that there is one world finally arrived at. So one world against many empires. That's why an American cannot be an imperialist. Not that he doesn't want to have much power, but he knows that there is only one world, that he would either have to rule the whole world, you see, or be satisfied with a role in it. But an empire is an ancient institution, gentlemen, that has gone on for the last 2,000 years still, which believes that it could, like China, be a world by itself. And the Chinese Wall is a very good expression of this idea that the world didn't have to be one, you see. It could be separate. We could have many worlds. So, the world wars, gentlemen, have ended this lesson. Because today we perish if we do not treat each other as living on one planet. And you may still think of war, of the Third World War, but I think nobody in his five senses in Washington thinks that a Third World War can ever be waged. You see, the two world wars are instruction enough for the fact that we just can't go to war. That's why we have to arm so heavily, gentlemen. That's not a contradiction. It's the only way in which you can prevent the Third World War. But the bomb must never be thrown. There will be no war, or there will be no history, or no human race. And the third thing, gentlemen, it's a little more difficult. We have, as you know, in this country, a very funny book that's called The Social Register. And it contains the people who think they belong to good society. Now, all these thousands of years, gentlemen, society was in the plural. That is, there were many societies, secret and otherwise. And today we are beginning to grasp the fact that it's only the beginning, the dawn, that as we write church with a capital C, and as we may write the world with a capital W, so we in the future will not succeed for making peace among men if you cannot write society with a capital S and put it in the singular, peace-based society. Or as Mr. Littman said, catering to the social register, has called it the good society. If you have, has anybody seen Mr. Walter Lippmann's book on this topic this time? Is it still known? It was a great success 30 years ago, The Good Society. Nobody has seen it? Not even heard of it? You have? Well, it's a very important book of our period in transition, gentlemen. It wouldn't have appeared to the Americans, who are after all 18th century people, if they had called it the Great Society, as a Marxian would. So the Marxian speaks of the society, you see, in the singular. We try to fend this off, it's a disagreeable idea, and so the good society has still some openness in this respect, you see. It doesn't unify us all. But we see that in the end, or at the end of the course, I hope to show you that the task is tremendous. It's just beginning. The next 1,000 years, gentlemen, in which I believe, in which most Americans do not believe, that there is still a future for 1,000 years for us, we'll have this tremendous task of unifying human beings of all ways and walks of life. And that then would be a third unit that would be the great society. And it would mean that as there is one God, and nobody today, I think, in his five senses would doubt this, there's also one world and no empires in it, and there must be created by you and me and by all our descendants the great society. This great society must contain all men of all walks of life, of all races. It doesn't at this moment. You just have to go to Alabama to know that. And it is an error to believe that this can be done by the United States alone. Any progress we have made in desegregation, gentlemen, has only happened by outside pressures from Russia and from Africa and from the other nations. The South wouldn't move if we had not these international pressures on us. You see that the Great Society is coming forward in Rhodesia, you see, and it's coming forward in Pakistan, and so it even comes into the South. But it is not an American story, not at all. As you know, as long as it was an American story, before the two world wars, before the world had become one and the new society is now the great on the agenda, the South could always say these damn Yankees, you see, these carpet beggars. Now they can't say it since Mr. Myrdal, the Swede, has written this great book on the Negro question. It's an international scandal now. And that is not an international scandal, gentlemen. It is a human scandal. That is, the world is so much one, you see, that the people all over the globe have now influence in each other's actions, regardless of state boundaries. Don't think that you are sovereign in dealing with the issue of the races in this country. You are not. That's a common human enterprise at this moment. However this may be, I'm not going into the details, I only have to say that much to shock you into the awareness that there is order in history. All history is not bunk, and history is not anecdote, and history is certainly not headlines in the newspapers. But it's a serious business, gentlemen, to finish the job which our Maker has entrusted to us. And the thing he has entrusted to us is unity out of plurality in our era. And Christ came into the world to say that there should be neither Jew nor Greek, neither Egyptian nor Roman, and he has in neither slave nor freeman, where that's the program. By the way, most people accept it to pay lip service to it. And he has also, as you know, stated to everybody that God created heaven and earth, and he did not create the United States. And he didn't create China. No, this all goes together. That's why I'm so frightened by this Tabukta of the American nation. Because you might rest on your laurels and think that finally we have now, you see, become finite and just can settle down and go good national. You cannot, I'm afraid. Because God is carrying his purpose out in a great hurry. It has only taken him 1,000 years by and large in the Western world to finish the gods, the pagan gods. And to put, even in Iceland, some idea into the heads of these people that there was one God. As you know, if I put this 1, 2, 3 here, it is obvious, gentlemen, that the task of bringing the domination of one Lord, as we say, under God in our formulas today to escape nationalism, government under God, is always a singular, that this has still some headway to make. There are still countries where this faith has to be preached, and I would like you all to come to my friend Henry Kramer's lecture on Sunday. He is a great authority on world mission and world policy, and that's, I have chosen this topic for his lecture myself in connection with this course. And I hope you will represent Dartmouth, all of you, because this man has lived in Indonesia as a Dutchman and has seen these problems of world policy, that is of empire building and empire crumbling, but also of Christianity and also of society. He was the head of the Ecumenic Institute near Geneva. And this is an attempt to make all the religions draw together. Because the unity, gentlemen, of the work of mission, the fight of God against the many gods, was in the Western world settled in thousand. But for other worlds, it of course is still going on. So if I put here the year 1000 and here the year 2000, it is probable that there will be something still to be done in other countries about the unity of the divinity. How then can I say that the first 1000 years, gentlemen, are devoted to the chasing out, to the expulsion of the many gods, when, as you may hold against me, missions are still needed today. Well, the reason I think I'm right in saying that by the year 1000 a certain incision can be made in our picture of the march of events is that the Western men by the year 1000 had inside their civilization done this task. Whether you were then a Muslim, or whether you were then a Jew, or whether you were an Eastern Christian, or whether you were a Western Church Christian, the plurality of the gods no longer was a problem. And so, beginning in 1000, the Norsemen, as you know, dedicated themselves to the discovery of the world, the natural world. And so what we can say is that in the year 1000, a part of the human race was emancipated for the second task of discovering the world. And all the great discoveries fall into the last 1000 years of our race. The last being the climbing of K2 and the Antarctic expedition, which we have now working where the Russians and the Americans are forced to work together because it is one world, you see. That sort of exists here under this dearly bought unity, which began with the great journeys of the Norsemen all around the globe. It seems that the Norsemen even went already in the 11th century below the equator and saw the cross of the south. We have at least in the 11th century or the 12th, I'm not sure now, some mentioning of this tremendous, you see, impression it made that there wasn't the northern star in the sky but the southern cross. That began only at that time. And now the world is discovered. And the difference, gentlemen, between expelling the gods and discovering the world is very considerable, because you can only discover the world if you do not believe that it is divine. It took Muslim and Christians, you see, and Jews, not to be afraid of the different gods in the different parts of the world, who before forbade men to enter there, you see, because they were those parts of the world, the other regions, were under the domination of some other ruler, of some other power in the sky, and in the woods, and in the mountains. The unity of God, gentlemen, has the effect, perhaps you take this down, it's, I think, for you, perhaps a new consideration. The unity of God has the effect that all parts of the world go worldly, become nothing but secular, worldly elements of nature, what you take for granted, gentlemen, but it had to be conquered. The world could only be discovered, gentlemen, when it was not an element of the gods that dominated it, you see. As long as there are gods and fairies and witchcraft, you see, you refrain from entering this wilderness. And all our fairy tales still remind you of a time when part of the world was bewitched and you couldn't go there. Now, the last 1000 years have freed us from these fears. Because there is one God, there is also one world. And what is the world then? The world is that part of our knowledge and our reality and our dealings and our residence and our habitation, which we do not have to fear, which we can master, which is given to us as the object of our irrigation, exploitation, construction, use, and whatever we call it. That's a new thing, a very new thing. We will compare the Aswan Dam as it may be built tomorrow with the old sacred Nile, and you will perhaps then realize how long it took the Egyptians to, Mr. Nasser is an exponent of this today, to treat their own country just as nature, just as a part of the world, you see. The sacred Nile has been a part of the divine life of the country for the last 5,000 years, and therefore you perhaps understand why between 1000 and 2000 something really new has happened The many gods became one god, and now the many worlds have become one world. The good society, gentlemen, is still far from being. You well know that you are not received in every house in the country just because you want to. Every moment we break again by our division of labor into parts. You just have to read the descriptions in Fortune about the new setup in a little town where one big corporation rules, and the president can have a Jaguar and the vice president can have a Cadillac, and so down it goes, you see. But woe to the man who has a long car.
So, the class of society which we had in this country is disappearing first. And therefore, some fight will have to go on in the future. Since the world is discovered, gentlemen, all people have the same religion, more or less. Or more or less, I should say less. The good society, that is the unity of the human race, that everybody can intermarry everybody else, for example, or be friends with everybody else, of which here this college is an attempt, of course, is not yet achieved.
Not by a long shot. You just ask the Arabs and the Israelis, they tell you it will never be achieved. One has to be, you see, extirpated, according to them.
So then we haven't yet created out of all men one man, out of all societies and all groups one society. This singular is not in existence. We can only prophesy it, and we can only expect it, and we can only see why it should be necessary.
One of the reasons is, for example, that we will be lost if we are divided in case of an invasion from Mars, or if we invade Mars. This dream today to go to another planet is of course conditioned by the total unity of the human race. You can see this. And an inner unity. We must not have any black joy over the misfortunes of the Russians. Otherwise, the connection with the Mars or with the Moon becomes absolutely fatal to our very existence. Can you see this? That the unity of the race today is predicated on our very progress in physics. The Earth can only have one ambassador, so to speak, outside itself, you see. If they work that at cross purposes, you see, this is unthinkable. Cannot send to Mars a communist and an American.
What I have tried to say is, gentlemen, that the fact that there is still mission going on in the thousand years of world discoveries, and that there will be still discoveries and missions go on in the next thousand years, does not mean that the emphasis, the theme of history has not changed. The unity of God, the singleness of God, the singularity of God, the singleness of the world, and the unity of human society, or its singleness, that there is one great man in all of us as elements and cells alive, that is the topic, although all these things also are going on at the same time. But you talk today to any Christian missionary and he knows that the social problems, you see, must first be solved before what he says makes sense. So the reverse order is today that you have to start the day with the social thing, you see, if you want to be understood with regard to the others. And so I think we have this very great privilege, gentlemen, to know where we are standing today, where we are going to, and where we are coming from. We are coming from a great adventure in unity of 2,000 years, and we are at the eve of the unifying the man as he is split in sex and race and division of labor.
and climate and many other similar influences. The countries are already unified. You can buy a globe and you see all of it. The people are not unified, not even in the same country. The triumph, gentlemen, of the world millennium is that the world has become a planet. That is, we can think of the world now not in terms of a map, but of a body in movement within the universe. And I offer you this word planet to show you that at the end of such a story, even the name for what has been discovered or what has been treated or what has been unified changed, you see. If you want to understand today the globe, you talk sense, you see. If you only speak of the world, you do not know quite what you mean. The world are many things, and it can be something outside the earth. But that our earth has to be a planet and has to be treated as a planet, that is today the achievement of this march into unity. So the creation of the planet, you could say, is this, you see. And the first chapter would be then the creation of the divinity of men. And the last story would be that men becomes complete. The events, gentlemen, of the first 1,000 years are, of course, all events in the history of the church or of religion. Any event that's interesting in the first 1,000 years of our era, gentlemen, are all related to the church. In some form or other. Even Constantine, the Emperor or Justinian, are only interested, you see, with regard to their relation to the Christians, or Nero. Why is Nero remembered? Because he birthed the Christians. Otherwise, he would just be one of the many Hindu tyrants. Nobody would, you see, have to know Mr. Nero. You see, you don't know all the despots in India, and you don't have to. They're better than going. But he's only interesting because he tried to resist the mission, you see, of Christianity. So all the emperors in the first 1,000 years are only interesting because of the missions. Charlemagne is remembered because he baptized the Saxons. You know, Mr. Hitler was very angry over that. So the first 1,000 years are under this impact of mission and church. The second age consists of mighty world revolutions and world wars. And I still am shy to give the developments of society in the future any term. You have just to wait and see. The names themselves for these events will be coined as we go along. And you see that we have no phrases from this terrible word desegregation, which obviously is a ridiculous word, you see, because it is too complicated. It's not a party word, you see, and it shows that we are embarrassed. We just have not yet discovered what it's all about. As soon as you get such a non-word, you can always be sure that mankind hasn't yet a good conscience about what it's doing. It has no poetry. It has no power to say the things it wants to say. After all, desegregation says we lost the Civil War and we have now to make up for that. I mean the North.
So, gentlemen, every one of the terms of this story were coined in this story. And that's why you must understand that we can know where we are at this moment, halting, but we cannot know how to call all the things that we shall have to do, because part of the doing is the same. And you must help in finding the right terms. And I offer you only desegregation as an example for the dead-end street in which we are today. If you speak of desegregation, you haven't yet fathomed the depths of the problem. Because nobody will accept this word. It doesn't have in it the power of solving anything. It's just negative. And set is negative, and D is negative, and in politics it isn't as in arithmetic, you see, 2 minus do not make a plus.
So, We have one advantage, gentlemen, that we are located in time at a certain point between two great events, or two great enterprises, or two great steps. And you well know that where we stand and what has to be done is mostly omitted from your history book. If you read this book, The American Nation, you see, that is so confined. It's a story from 1865 to today. And neither before nor afterwards, you see, is there any connection with what has happened before. And so I am boastful enough to say to you that the merit of this course should be that it gives you orientation. Orientation. I don't mean orientation about other people's confusion, but about your own. That is, to become oriented is a matter for the man himself to ask for orientation. And it is not to be oriented about other people's orient, you see, or Occident. And my course is an attempt, of course I told you, I wanted to know this myself, by which I have tried to orient myself in my actions, so that I should know what is sterile and what is futile, and what is necessary and what is fruitful. And you yourself will have to find out whether it is fruitful. I had a very nice example of this problem. A young friend, a Dartmouth man, 3 years ago, he graduated, 3 or 4 years ago. He went to see an European and in New York consult with him about his future. And he's a wealthy boy, and so he said, well, I want to find something by which I can improve human relations in the world. Wants to go into business. So therefore, I do not want to sell Coca-Cola. Where the European was said to him, I'm not so sure. Perhaps the right way to do this, improve human relations, is just to sell Coca-Cola. You never can tell. It's so difficult, you know, to know what is the right thing. Everyone has to know himself. That is, fortunately, no planner, gentlemen, and no president, and no churchman can tell you what you should do for the furthering of the human society. One has may have to sell Coca-Cola, another may not. But I mean to say in general, so to speak, that any action in society is false, and the other is useful, is impossible. There are no generalities, gentlemen, in the great society. In the great society, everybody has his own place, his own hour. That's very wonderful, you see. Completely free. You have to make the decision. Nobody can make it for you. If he makes a decision for you, you have ceased to be a member of the good society. And therefore, the hour is really very exciting, because in the great society, gentlemen, every one of us will have to play his unique function. And nobody can ever take from him this responsibility. You will have to find whether you should sell motor cars or television sets. And no placement office of darkness, gentlemen, can take this responsibility from you. There's no excuse. Because the corporations bribe you, gentlemen, that's no reason why you should take a bribe. You are accustomed that mayors shouldn't be bribed, judges shouldn't be bribed. Gentlemen, I tell you, you shouldn't be bribed. That's much more difficult. You can always sit in judgment over all these politicians who can be grafted. There's graft, you say, in New York City. Of course there's graft in New York City, but there's more graft in Dartmouth College. You are all grafted and bribed. And you take the bribe. Because you are sound asleep and you don't think that you are responsible for anything. If somebody offers you $10,000 a year, you say, of course. Gentlemen, if you do not begin to say the opposite from of course, gentlemen, you don't live. Most of you will never live, of course, I know that. The great society, gentlemen, this we can say today with a slogan, will only consist of those people who are statistically unimportant. Because the man who is statistically unimportant cannot be confounded and confused with anybody else.
A man who is statistically important, you see, is a number. And a man who is statistically unimportant is not a number. Now, the whole problem of desegregation of any unity in the human family is, you see, that you must force upon the people that you are Marian Anderson. And they must forget that you are a colored woman. And then you are a member of the great society, which is to come, obviously. And she does, of course, for hundreds of others of her race, this service, because there's one who does this, who cannot be bribed.
Well, that's an aside. This is the program of the course. And now comes the very stunning and startling thing, gentlemen, that the church has become the new Israel. That is the church. That is, she has given to all men the fatherhood of the one God for which the Israelites have suffered all these thousands of years. The new world, gentlemen, the planet Earth, is the empire of all empires. That's the new planet. There is no China, and there is no Germany, and there is no British Empire today, and there is one world. And therefore, gentlemen, the second thousand years of our era, that is chapter 6, has absorbed that which was still waiting to be absorbed or unified from time immemorial. And today, gentlemen, when we enter the great society, we must unify all human tongues. Tongues are speeches, all human languages. All people must learn to speak to each other
in their daily lives.
And so, gentlemen, what is happening today is that we need to form a tribe out of all tribes. And that will be chapter 7 of our history. And you can see then that our era is going backward, absorbing the antiquity in comparison to the ancient marching order, the tribes first, the empire second, the Jews third, the Greeks fourth. We now have seen that the church has absorbed the Israelites, that is the last 1500 years before Christ. The one world movement, the discovery of the whole world, has absorbed the empires that go back to 4000 BC, you see. And now we are dealing with primitive people, Margaret Mead, and well, what's she doing? She's taking us back before Babylon and China and India, you see, into ages of the beginnings of the old race. That's called anthropology. And or prehistory or archaeology or however you call it, it is simply true that we are now only embarking on the waking up of the achievements of the people before the Jews, before the Greeks, before the Egyptians, primitive people. And the great desire in all of us to know a little bit about their ritual and their folklore. Now the mysterious thing for your notebook, gentlemen, is just to make you see how orderly the proceedings are, that the church had to unlock the gates of Jerusalem and to make the new Israel out of the old Zion. All the church songs are full of these loans from the Old Testament, as you well know, you see. And it's very serious, gentlemen, that then the second step was to go back and to see the world as men's empire and know one part of the world. And that there is no emperor today in the whole world. Wherever you go,
That's a very remarkable fact, gentlemen. The world has engulfed all the emperors and all the empires. You must know this because, gentlemen, that's the reason why the American language is immune against the use of imperialism, you see. The deepest reason is that this is a new world in which you have waited for the time that all the world would become one. And it could only become one if there were no separate empires. This has happened, but it means that we have delved more deeply in the past, and we have now eliminated the empires of old, which started, as I said, by and large 4,000 or 3,000 BC. And today the great society, as far as it will be victorious, will go back to the tribesmen and redeem their languages and their forms of life, or make them understood and make use of them for our own benefit. So that's a very mysterious story then. And if you say then that the Christian era reabsorbs or revitalizes or re-evokes the past in the reverse order in which it was created. The creation of speech in the tribes is now on the agenda as a task of the great society. The creation of walls and palaces and governments and worlds by themselves has been replaced by the one world of Miss Admiral Birch. And the new Israel has replaced the old Israel. And that has happened in reverse order. And it fills me with great reverence, gentlemen, to discover that everything that was created in the past had to come under scrutiny, had to be unified, and all these multiplicities of antiquity, you see, now can be singularized. But that there was an order, nothing could be done out of the time order. The last gentleman then of antiquity was the first to become unified in our own era. Can you see this? Is there any question about this? It's very important that you should see that history is not, as you think, just a running white of power and without any rhyme or reason, just like water running down the hill. It is not, gentlemen. When the world was created once, when the times were fulfilled, a new order enters the scene, a new task, the task of unity. And that is what we call Christianity. You don't know this, and you think Jesus was just a nice high school senior who would have lost his religion in Dartmouth College. He had a very supreme God. He is God's majesty on earth, gentlemen. He is a giver of your and my law of life. And it's very serious business, gentlemen, that you could as soon as possible eliminate your prejudice against Jesus as a nice member of the YMCA. He is the Lord of creation. He has made us understood that we have to create God's world and not, cannot leave it to accident. That's very serious business. But the order which is revealed now to you and everybody, any human being today, can see this, that there is a stringent and severe order. And you all will be miserable, gentlemen, if you don't respect this order. You cannot find your place in life without now knowing this order of things. That is, I think, a very glorious order, because it means that every gift of man can be enfolded and put in its place, and nothing that has ever been created by genius or talent in any part of the world has to be forgotten or cannot be put to life again. There's nothing, no Stone Age language or lingo that we cannot use and arm ourselves with it, so to speak, as a weapon for our own future. You'll see this, of course, more clearly when you understand what is achieved by speech, which you hardly, at this moment, I think, take seriously enough. Let's have a break now.
Anyway, I had many interesting questions, but nobody has shown me up for cheating.
Yet I did cheat you. And I have to say something about the Greeks. While the Jews were preparing the unity of our worship, of our and the revelation of our Creator, I told you that the Greeks set out to revitalize the elements, fire and air and poetry in the Greek tragedy, in Homer, in philosophy, in the arts, in sculpture, whatnot. Now, where are the Greeks in our own era? I have not assigned to them either a 4,000 years or any place hitherto. Yet you know we are here in a good institution that has been reborn in the so-called Renaissance. We are in a liberal arts college. That's Greece in darkness, little as you may suspect it. And therefore the Greeks are the muses, the accompanions of the good life, gentlemen, in any time. Of our era, we need them to sharpen our senses and sharpen our sensations. Tonight Mr. Vatra is going to read poetry. And why is it worth our while to listen to his translations from the Greek? Because you have to import into this stale American taxi driver lingo some poetry. And he does it, because he translates Greek poetry. And I think that darkness would be a better place if fewer of you would indulge in this trite language. If you would sharpen your taste and your senses, and would add to your jazz records some others, which you, by the way, already do. There's a great revival of musical interest in this country, which means that the Greeks are with us all the time as companions. And therefore there is no special era, no special 1,000 years to be assigned to the Greeks. The Greeks are the school, the good spirit of the schools. And young people have to be educated in any generation, be it of the church, you see, be it of the world, or be it of society. And therefore the Greeks, gentlemen, are an ingredient of history in our era. They are never the pilots, they are never the oarsmen or the steerer, the statesmen, but they are the ingredients, as we call the Greek spirit, the spirit of the muses. It isn't just the word music, gentlemen, that is derived from the muses, but all history writing, you see, all poetry, all art is under the care of one of the 9 muses. And they give us the charm of life. In trying to prepare myself for this class, I ran into a very beautiful verse of the old Greek half-god Empedocles, who was a sage in Akropas on Sicily, and he has left us a great poem about nature and another on the purity of the human heart. He jumped into the volcano of the Etna to end his life. And great man, he declined to become prince of his city. He said they should be free men and should have no prince. Now this man Empedocles has just one short line. The muse is frightened by necessity. The muse is frightened by necessity. That is the graces too. The muses and graces are frightened by necessity. The Greeks, gentlemen, are the companions of our leisure. The very word leisure is a Greek invention. And leisure, gentlemen, is the lubrication of necessary lives. The Greeks are not for the necessary. They are for the play. They are therefore the name givers of the Olympic Games, for example. Sport is not serious. Who has taken philosophy 9 with me? Well, you know that
how important it is to draw this dividing line. Now the Greeks are responsible for the training of our mind and of our body, you see, in our schools, in our divinity. And therefore, they are the companions of the good life. And I think I should say this much right away about the Greeks, so that you cannot say that I neglected their creation. But they do not belong into the serious and necessary march of events, you see, because they are for the young in us, ourselves, for our eternal youth. They are not for the virility of decisions. And to cinch this matter, I want to leave with you a memorable verse which Goethe, the German poet, wrote into the album of his son. He had a son who was an eyesore. He died, by the way, at an early age, the age of 35, from alcoholism. And the father could not pride himself that he had enriched the world by this one son who survived out of many children who died in childhood. Well, this son came before his father, who was, after all, the greatest poet of the German tongue, and asked him to put something memorable into his album. And the father has written this line, which I shall first say it in German, then I shall translate it. Söhnchen, merke dir bei Zeiten, wenn sich Herz und Sinn erhöht, dass die Muse zu begleiten, doch zu leiten nicht versteht. That means, son, my dear son, keep this in mind from the very beginning, when your heart and your senses wake up. The muse knows how to accompany, but it does not know to lead. This is very important, gentlemen. The muse does not know to lead. She is our companion. She is for leisure. That's why to become an artist is such a curse and such a serious decision. You can only do it if you can't help it, so to speak. There must be artists, and we must hope that some undergoes the hardship of becoming an artist. But you can never, so to speak, have a placement office for artists. You understand? It must be in his heart such a drive that he will overcome the hardships which are involved, because an artist has no leader, leading principle. His whims, his impressions, he's impressionistic. And so he's swayed like by any whirlwind, by any storm. You just compare the making of an artist and the making of a doctor. In a name of doctors, all is streamlined. The direction is perfectly clear, you see. Serious. There's a sick child. He has to know certain things, you see it. But take a poet who finds the new technique of writing a television play on, so nobody can help him. It's his originality. Hit or miss, you see. Mostly miss. So this verse, I think, is of central importance to put the Greeks in their place. There is no, in this sense, no history, gentlemen, of art. There's a constant revitalization of the arts. In every generation, we must pray that we have somebody who sharpens you and my senses, so that we do not see, I don't care, and well, so what, you see. The artist comes into the world against the so what attitude, gentlemen. This country will have no artists as long as the man who says so what is not slow and chased out of town. As long as he can pose as the true American, so what, then you can have no art. Because the artist is the man who says, how wonderful, how strange, never heard of this before. The artist makes us see things for the first time. You learn in physics that the sun is not going up and setting down. The earth turns around the sun. So you say, so what? Now comes an artist and says, I've never seen the sunrise before. And he describes to you the first sunrise of the world. And if you read his poem about the sunrise, you say,
mind. If I mean, that is a colossal affair.
You know, it is a colossal affair that the son wires. And it's a very dirty affair that we say he doesn't wire it. It's infinite. I assure you, I have seen the sunrise. And that's more important to me than the physical law that the earth turns around the sun. That's a very minor fact compared to the great impression which the sunrise can make on you or me.
That's the artist begins again. That is, he takes us back to the whole march of events from the first men who wandered over the rising of the sun to the last physicist who finally discovered that after all it wasn't such a very important or dangerous affair. That's a long story of some thousand years. But if nobody had ever said, had this sense of wonder about the first sunrise which he realized, you see, obviously there would have been no physicist ever to make it trite and to make it true. Can you see this? The artist takes us back to this whole march of events that ends in Mr. Einstein. But Mr. Einstein is an end product, and the artist is a first product. And we need all the creatures. We need somebody who has the sensibility of the first man, or we will fall into the clutches of the people who are the last man, you see, and who have no sensibility left, because they say, so what, I know it all. You gentlemen are in great danger of siding with the so what people. How many of you come from New York?
Well, watch out.
Now let me connect this scheme, these seven chapters, with what we have to say first to discover what the theme of history was. May I ask for a piece of chalk? We have four steps by which man is thrown out of nature. We are all deprived of our first nature. He said there is the yearning of the prehistoric man. He is full of promise. That's you, my dear gentleman. You are full of promise. Then comes the big event by which somebody does something for the first time. And then comes the, how did we call it, the inheritance of acquired faculties. They're once forever. This is once, and this is the going on forever. Now the full man, as we think of a human being, has come into the world only with the beginning of our era. And so the whole antiquity can be treated as prehistory, as the promise, as the Bible does. You see, the coming of the real man is promise, and finally he enters the scene, and everybody can now become everything. You can say, gentlemen, that the whole antiquity said that there should be in the tribe chieftains, or let me allow me the word king, that's the same, a man of his sibling. A king is a man who has a dynasty, who is the same word as chieftain really in its meaning. The created kingship, that is the essence for which you have to have speech. Then they created priests and temples. That is the business of writing. We still call our divine house of service, the house of divine service, the temple of the Lord. And then we got prophets in Israel, and we got poets in Greece.
These are the two, four more most generalized types of
humanity which were created: kings, priests, prophets, and poets are the creation of these four chapters in antiquity. Now we can say, gentlemen, that the great event of our era is that you and I can say everybody a king, everybody a prophet, everybody a poet, and everybody a priest of the Lord.
You believe in the universal priesthood. You all believe that you have an eye to the creative arts, which makes you into a poet of some sort. Take the word artist instead if you prefer. Makes no difference.
And we are all, therefore, entitled. The great event of our era is that all this is changed into everybody. And the first man who brought us this promise is the event from which this everybody can acquire this acquired faculty. So it makes sense to say, gentlemen, in this aspect, that our own knowledge of history bears out my contention that for any new quality, there are these four phases: the natural condition, the yearning for the solution, the prehistory, the event in which the solution enters the scene for the first time, and the spread and the survival and the inheritance and the transmission of this quality to all and sender. In this sense, gentlemen, then the first rule that man is not a part of nature, because he has the three chapters of promise, event, and transmission or inheritance to the new things to the natural state of nature, comes true in our whole picture. But let me repeat, gentlemen, any new quality in the human race goes through these four phases. So what I say here about the universal picture of our last 7,000 years, that there is to be distinguished between the nature, the animal nature, the hope and expectation and awaiting and yearning for the desired quality, the promise, the prehistory, then the historical event by which it enters the scene, and then the tremendous sweating and hardship to keep it going, that this is true about any part of history and about the whole of history. You can write the history of painting, you can write the history of speech, you can write the history of any of social work, of any such new aspect of humanity, you see, in terms of these four chapters. But the great thing is that the full history of humanity is also written exactly in the same style. There are these four elementary things. We come out of the animal kingdom, where we have no change. All the things that people tell you about mutation, gentlemen, so is simply not so. Under our eyes, one new animal species has changed. They are just there. And the plant species, you can crossbreed them, of course, you can hybridize them, you can improve them, and you can select them, but they're just there. And the mules remain the mules. That is, you can't go very far with the creation of new races in the animal kingdom. With men is different. Men has a promise that can be fulfilled, and we are thrown beyond nature. We are thrown beyond nature, gentlemen. Mr. Sartre, the pagan existentialist, has expressed this. You see that he says, man is thrown into the future. You may know this sentence, which is just another definition of man's leaving nature behind. You see, he's thrown into the future. That's all we know at first. But the future consists out of these three steps, gentlemen: the yearning, the expectation, the entering of the decision of an event. And I want you to repeat this fact, gentlemen. All human histories, parts of history, must be divided in the same manner as the universal history. You take the American history, obviously 1620 is the state of nature. 1620 to 1775 is the prehistory, you see. 1776 to 1815 I would call the founding period, you see, the event. The United States come into their own. And from then on, it's a problem, you see, of making you into Americans. Therefore, this country also has a story that consists of these four chapters. Nature, prehistory, event, and transmission, or inheritance. It's useful, I think, for you to see that the big order writes the law for the small orders. You have grown up in this terrible, really terrible, zoo thinking. It's a zoo thinking because you believe that the whole is built up by the parts. But of course, gentlemen, the parts cannot be understood without the whole. The American history makes no sense if not the whole of history makes sense. And first we must make sure that all history makes any sense before your history makes any sense. And therefore, we first have to know, as the Bible always has held, what it's all about man, before you can know what's the matter with American history. And the American history is just a little detailed specimen of the lawful order of all historical development. The evolution of the American history goes from nature to prehistory or promise of America, you see, to fulfillment. And the fulfillment consists of two things. Somebody has to live at first, as were the founding fathers, you see. And with the death of Jefferson and John Adams, it's over. And when the first generation is gone, you see, the hard task begins from scratch, not to allow the descendants and grandsons to forget, you see. And of course, by 1860, they had forgotten, you see. So the Civil War comes along and brings it back to their memory, you see, what the founding fathers really had done. They had created one unit, you see. In North Carolina, that had been decidedly forgotten. So, the history of America, gentlemen, is the special case or one application of the law of all history. And I assure you, the gist of the matter which I've tried to tell you today is that as long as you do not understand the whole, it is useless to try to understand the parts. Everything you have to learn in the humanities and the social sciences says the opposite to you. People try to understand the parts without even admitting that the whole might make any sense. If you want to know to what depravity the human mind has fallen, I recommend you to buy Mr. Nehru's universe book, Attempt to Write a Universal History. If I hadn't then by that time reached already some degree of maturity, I would have committed suicide after this reading this book. There's no hope for mankind. Everything is just, as the whole Indian worldview, spotty. Here's something, abracadabra, and there's something, barbaracadabra. And here is the American history, and there's Persian history, and there's Hindu history, and there's Roman history, and there's Egyptian history, and there's Chinese history. And if I would put you on your head and take out the shavings, that's what you would look like inside. Your mind is built the same way, this disorderly fashion that you know here's something, and you know there's something, and then you have the Webster dictionary to put it all together in alphabetical order. But as you know, the alphabetical order just is no order. It's no order. And the best you can do is you can know many, many words from the dictionary. I mean, that's no knowledge. I assure you the history of mankind is a severe business. It is nothing you can deal with at random. You have to rewrite your Bible yourself from your own experience, but you cannot go behind the Bible. You cannot fall short, so to speak, of what they already knew. That there was Adam the tribesman first, and Noah the empire builder second, and the builder of agriculture, and Moses the founder of Israel third, and the Greeks fourth. That's in the Bible, and that's simply true.
But you have despised it. This is just an obnoxious book, and you know all better because you buy the Encyclopedia Britannica or Africana. And gentlemen, we don't do a good job with you if you leave this college in this disorder, with such a disordered mind. Gentlemen, the whole of human history makes sense. The parts are much more difficult to find sense in, because people can go to pot. Whole nations like Spain, you see, or Albania, or Alabama, or Arkansas, or whatnot, can go to the devil. They can be omitted from the picture of history. But how can they? Unless the whole march of events is meaningful, you see. And if you ostracize this meaning, if you obstruct it, you can be left behind. In your naive taste, you know this. You say that Europe has lost its leadership in the last world wars. Everybody in America tells me this, you see. I was wondering how they know. How you know such a thing? Well, of course, you feel it, you sense it, you have a flair for this. But don't spell flair with F-L-A-R-E, as some of you do. I mean flair with F-L-A-I-R. One has to have a flair for dead dogs and dead cats. But you say no. You say you can't know any of these things. There is no order in history. There are no conditions under which the spirit, human spirit prevails and is victorious. Gentlemen, there are laws. The laws of the spirit are much more severe than the laws of electricity. The laws of the spirit are really the laws most easily understood, gentlemen. For example, in the Ten Commandments, it is said that if a murder is not punished in Mississippi, then there is no state of Mississippi left. And the murder wasn't punished, and so Mississippi, in my eyes, and I shall declare, it has ceased to be a state, an emancipated member of the United States. I'm sorry, but that's the case. And as long as the senator from this state can be the president, the chairman of the Judicial Committee of the United States Senate, I think the whole country is in an absolutely incredible state of corruption. Now, these important issues are not even mentioned in a nice college. Why? You talk about the atom bomb, and you talk about Pakistan, and you talk about many things that are not your business. You never talk about the things that are your business, because this you can only do if you believe that there are laws which, when disregarded, are visited on your children and family. Now, I believe naively in the Ten Commandments, and I believe that when we go against the laws of the spirit, gentlemen, the crimes which we commit of omission, that they are visited on our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. You just have to go to Texas and see the drought. If they plowed up too much land, the grandchildren of these landowners will still suffer from the fact. They went against the treatment of the soil, and they themselves may escape, but not their grandchildren. They have to leave. And you don't believe this, gentlemen. So news is all silly. Gentlemen, when the Jews were told by Moses that the transgressions of the forefathers were visited on their children and grandchildren in the third and fourth generation, then the fashion became in this country to say how cruel. This is not cruel, this is the truth. This is just a law which cannot escape. The consequences of a human transgression make themselves fail in the third and fourth generation. That's all there is to it. They only come to fruition, or to the opposite of fruition, after a certain lapse of time. We have to observe this, and we have just to respect it. And that's all there is to it. It has nothing to do with cruelty, and has nothing to do with mercy. It is just, you have the right to ruin God's plan. And you can take the whole United States out of history. That you cannot destroy history. That men must found one God, one world, and one society, gentlemen. That's revealed. That's true. That the United States can fall behind this march of events and become an interesting sideshow, you see. where then the Mr. DeSoto from Saudi Arabia will send tourists to look at these awkward, you see, obsolete people here in New England. That can happen. We can become obsolete. But that doesn't mean that we, when we become obsolete, life on this planet will not be lived in other parts of the world. Maybe the Chinese take over. We don't know this. But what I'm driving at, gentlemen, is you cannot understand one biography of Blake or of Shakespeare or whatnot, or of Willinger, if you do not have in mind the story of the human race as a whole. It makes no sense for you. Absolutely not. Because, for example, if you hold the view that there should be slaves and there should be difference of Negroes, as these people in the South still pretend to believe, then obviously Lincoln is a destroyer of civilization. How can you know that Lincoln is a great man? You see, he did the wrong thing. How do you know this, gentlemen? You all know it. What I invite you to do is to believe that you know it. To become aware of the fact that you know very well that history has a meaning and a unified meaning, and that you measure all partial histories from the whole and not the other way around. So, gentlemen, what I have tried to prove at this today is then the essential unity of all human history on this. Thank you.